Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, July 2nd. Talk about a relief rally. Stocks had their best week in 2 years, up 5% plus across the board, as Greece's parliament stepped back from the brink and approved a new austerity program as well as the tools to implement it, thus allowing the troika of the European Union, European Central Bank, and International Monetary Fund to fork over the next $17 billion in cash that is part of Greece Bailout 1. Greece will now be able to pay its debts through August. But yes, this is kicking Greece's inevitable default down the road. Come September, the troika will examine Greece's books and determine whether it deserves even more cash. At this point, it is also assumed the EU, ECB, and IMF will have approved Greece Bailout 2, which would seek to fund Greece through 2013, after which a new EU financial stability mechanism would take over the following year. So the Ponzi scheme continues, but if you ever doubted global markets would have crashed had Parliament not approved the austerity measures, think again how far we then rallied and doubled it to the downside. There are many details to be hashed out over the coming weeks and months, particularly with regard to Bailout 2, which, depending on how you measure it, would provide Greece with another $120 billion-plus. But one detail being left out of the financial calculations is the attitude of the public in places like Germany, Finland, and Austria, who are more than a bit tired of seeing their tax dollars going to help out what has proved to be a totally worthless and corrupt nation of lazy, spoiled, deceitful people. What I will continue to focus on, though, is Greece being part of the Balkans, as history has shown the region to be explosive in ways that were then crippling for the rest of the continent and beyond. Over time, the sporadic protest in Greece will turn increasingly violent. What happens then is anyone's guess, given a fragile and unpopular ruling government. For now, one of the options being worked out has French and German banks accepting a kind of Brady Bonds plan, this having been used to bail out Latin America over 20 years ago. The banks would voluntarily extend half of the debt, maturing over the coming 3 years into new 30-year bonds at 5.5% interest, the other half being refunded in cash, 30% of that, and a zero-coupon type security, 20%, that would have a kicker if Greece's economy grows beyond a target of, say, 2%. But in the end, it's still about Greece being able to enforce its austerity measures and collect taxes, and if the economy craters even worse than projected, needless to say, tax revenue will also fall woefully short. And Greece is dependent on the proceeds from its massive privatization program of everything from the power monopoly to beaches. Editorial, The Economist. Quote, on June 29, with tear gas billowing around the rioters outside the Greek parliament, politicians in principle backed a new punishing austerity plan. As The Economist went to press, they were expected to implement the austerity plan in a second vote. That would open the way for a Eurozone, for the Eurozone countries to approve a second rescue package for Greece, likely to be worth around $170 billion. I'll just note that The Economist is including the remains of the first bailout in that figure. Alas, Greece's austerity plan looks doomed to fail. It does little to prevent the epic folly of Greece's railways and other ruinous schemes. It will screw down too hard on ordinary Greeks with new taxes, spending cuts, and a rushed privatization scheme. And it will almost certainly condemn Greece to recession, strife, and an eventual debt default. Making Greece's economy work better would mean far greater changes to a dysfunctional state. That means defeating the unions, important allies for the politicians. It would also mean dismantling the system of patronage on which politicians thrive. Whether you are after a government job, a license, or a favorable tax assessment, politicians are essential allies. Greece needs transparent and impartial rules, but politicians are not keen to limit the scope for dishing out favors. Anyway, Greece's politicians reckon it's so long as they pretend to fix their country, the EU will hand over the money whether the plan succeeds or not. After all, who wants to pull the plug on Greece if that risks contagion across the Eurozone? Every quarter before the Eurozone countries and the IMF release the next tranche of aid, they must decide whether Greece is on track. Every quarter, it will become clearer that the answer is no. That was The Economist. Turning to the U.S., aside from the massive rally in equities, there were some legitimate positive surprises in the form of far better than expected manufacturing data from the Chicago Purchasing Managers Report and the National ISM reading for June. So these flew in the face of those concerned the soft patch was about to become something more. I fall in the camp that the second half will disappoint. Consumer spending for May, after all, was unchanged and undoubtedly influenced by high oil prices. If we head back to $100 a barrel and $4 at the pump, that mindset will return. And the housing data remains putrid. But a couple of things are coming up of particular note. First, next Friday's employment report for June. If we see another number in the 50 to 60,000 range like last time, that won't be good. And then on July 11, Alcoa starts us off with earnings season, and the succeeding 3 weeks will be packed with valuable information on the future direction of the economy and corporations' plans for hiring. The big item, however, potentially far bigger than Greece, is the August 2nd deadline for the U.S. debt ceiling. In discussing this, President Obama could not have been more obnoxious at his press conference on Wednesday, once again returning to his pathetic attack the rich spiel. At the same time, though, some of my fellow Republicans have to understand that any authentic deficit reduction program must contain some revenue enhancers as well as entitlement reform. Oklahoma Republican Senator Tom Coburn and Connecticut Independent Joe Lieberman introduced a plan, for example, that would raise the Medicare eligibility age to 67 from 65 and increase monthly premium sum, and as you'd expect, they were lambasted by both sides of the political aisle. And you know how last week I quoted North Dakota Democratic Senator Kent Conrad, who said any real deficit reduction plan needs to be in the $4 trillion neighborhood over 10 years, not $2 trillion, to be realistic? All I'm seeing the past few days is a plan that would come in under $2 trillion. This won't work. I'm telling you, get ready for the crash of 2012. And to those Republicans who think they can jerk around with the debt ceiling deadline, from what I understand on August 3rd, government workers and Social Security recipients would be among those who stop getting paid. Go ahead and say, so what? Just be prepared for the consequences in terms of the overall economy. I'm all for reducing the government roles further, and Social Security must be part of the solution. But Republicans will not enhance their 2012 chances if a large portion of the electorate stops getting their checks. The thing is, our situation is so increasingly hopeless that unless our president gets his act together, as well as the congressional leadership, we're doomed, pure and simple. Consider the following from Lawrence Lindsay in an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal. In discussing how existing deficit projections could skyrocket further, Lindsay says, there are at least three major reasons for concern. First, a normalization of interest rates would upend any budgetary deal if and when one should occur. At present, the average cost of Treasury borrowing is 2.5%. The average of the last two decades was 5.7%. Should we ramp up to the higher number, annual interest expenses would be roughly $420 billion higher in 2014 and $700 billion higher in 2020. The second reason for concern is that official growth forecasts are much higher than what the academic consensus believes we should expect after a financial crisis. That consensus holds that economies tend to return to trend growth of about 2.5%, without ever recapturing what was lost in the downturn. But the president's budget of February 2011 projects economic growth of 4% in 2012, 4.5% in 2013, and 4.2% in 2014. That budget also estimates that the 10-year budget cost of missing the growth estimate by just 1 point for 1 year is $750 billion. So if we just grow at trend those 3 years, 2.5%, we will miss the president's forecast by a cumulative 5.2 percentage points and, using the numbers provided in his budget, incur additional debt of $4 trillion. Third, is increasingly clear that the long-run cost estimates of Obamacare were well short of the mark because of the incentive employers will have under that plan to end private coverage and put employees on the public system. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius has already issued 1,400 waivers from the Act's regulations for employers as large as McDonald's to stop them from dumping their employees' coverage. But a recent McKinsey survey, for example, found that 30% of employers with plans will likely take advantage of the system, with half of the more knowledgeable ones planning to do so. If this survey proves correct, the extra bill for taxpayers would be roughly $74 billion in 2014, rising to $85 billion in 2019, thanks to the subsidies provided to individuals and families purchasing coverage in the government's insurance exchanges. Only serious long-term spending reduction in the entitlement area can begin to address the nation's deficit and debt problems. It should no longer be credible for our elected officials to hide the need for entitlement reform behind rosy economic and budgetary assumptions. And while we should all hope for a deal that cuts spending and raises the debt ceiling to avoid a possible default, bondholders should be under no illusions. That was Lawrence Lindsay. Oh, it's going to get interesting these next few weeks. If the White House and Congress adopt a credible deficit reduction plan, the markets will have every reason to rally further. That would be great. I'm not short. But if this plan isn't credible, with zero hope of the issue being readdressed until 2013 after the election, I've told you what we have to look forward to. And if the debt ceiling is allowed to expire without action, if you are leaving it to the likes of Republican strategist Grover Norquist to tell you how markets would react, you're nuts. A note on commodities. I've been saying that the diversified CRB index would finish the year below the 12/31/10 closing figure of 332.80. And we ended the quarter at 338.05 and finished the week at 336.71. Oil was among the items leading a rebound the past 5 days as the Greece crisis ebbed and the dollar weakened. But wheat and corn were among those hit hard. So just to back up. Last May 28, I discussed the dire crop report from the Agriculture Department as prices were soaring and added, quote, "I would just emphasize that the picture can change quickly." I then noted an anecdote from my farmer friends in the Oklahoma Panhandle, who in discussing the severe drought there told me, quote, "Yes, it is dry, but if you can believe it, the wheat is not as bad as they are saying," close quote. That was in an area that I told you had received a quarter inch of rain in over 200 days before Carol Lee told me of two decent rains they had received in May. Well, wouldn't you know, but this week the same folks at the Department of Agriculture told us that farmers planted 92 million acres of corn, 2% more than projected, and that stockpiles as of June 1 were 12% higher than forecast. Farmers also planted 3% more acres of spring wheat than projected, and inventories of same are now 5% more than initially estimated. So wheat tumbled and corn outright crashed. Since reaching a record $8 a bushel on June 10, corn is down over 25% as it closed the week under 6. I also saw this week that the Russian wheat crop should be normal this year after last year's catastrophic drought. In 2010, Russia harvested 61 million tons, but this year is now projected to reach 82 to 86 million, though here, as in the U.S., is still mostly about July's weather. Finally, regarding quantitative easing part D, or QE2, the program sure pumped asset prices since it was announced by Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, end of last August. The prime purpose was to ensure the U.S. economy didn't tip into deflation, and prices indeed rose. But in terms of helping housing recover, it was an abysmal failure. Not that I'd ever thought it would be a success. Because while mortgage rates remained at historic lows, banks had pulled in their horns, big time, in terms of approving new mortgages. And for those even looking to refinance, there was the none-too-small issue of 25% or more of homeowners being underwater. And in actuality, the 10-year Treasury rose from 2.50% when Bernanke announced his program to nearly 3.20% by June 30. This despite the fact that the Fed purchased anywhere from 80 to 85% of the net Treasury issuance, according to various estimates by Wall Street Economist. Now that QE2 is over, who is going to soak up a projected $94 billion each month? True, the Fed will continue to buy Treasuries with the proceeds from the mortgage back and Treasury debt it owns, but that is estimated to result in about $15 billion worth of Fed buying a month, not the $75 billion or so it would be given earlier percentages. Editorial, Washington Post. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that this was, QE2 that is, in the end, a holding action. QE2 is not so much an asset-buying program as a time-buying program. Time for America's households, firms, and governments to deleverage and heal as best they could. QE2 is over and unlikely to be repeated. Mr. Bernanke was not kidding last August when he said central bankers alone cannot solve the world's problems. Meanwhile, the prospects of much more fiscal stimulus seem doubtful. For better or worse, the U.S. economy may be on its own, as the Washington Post. Well, what a difference a week makes in terms of stocks. The broad averages had their best week in 2 years since July 2009, as the Dow Jones rose 5.4% to 12,582, the S&P advanced 5.6%, and NASDAQ soared 6.1% to 2816. That's all for this week. Have a great 4th of July holiday. I'll be back with you next Saturday. For more information, go to stocksandnews.com and click on Week in Review. Take care.